All right. Another one. Another episode. This time we have the most successful ginger industrial broker in town.
Maybe
the only ginger, but yet that makes you the most successful.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, man. Longtime friend and competitor and building owner partner and all the things. Matt Elliott. What's up, man?
Thanks, dude. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for letting me come do this.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you're here, man. This is going to be exciting. So, Matt, NAI Robert Lynn, Executive VP and Principal. So, I kind of grew up on the sidelines of y'all all the time and then got into the brokerage business, but you know, I was always kind of hanging around Robert Lynn and seeing you guys, hanging out with my brother and stuff. So, but let's get into it, man. Let's just hear your story. Where are you from?
So I am from Beaumont, Texas.
Okay.
I originally grew up there and then went to school in Chicago actually the main reason is because I was too fucking dumb to get into Notre Dame.
But you were determined to go to Chicago and go to school pretty much or what?
Well, my parents were like, you need to go to a Catholic school, which I never really understood that. I thought that was kind of a dumb thing.
Yeah.
But in hindsight, it was a great experience. But after 4 years of being up there, I was like, I can't deal with this shit anymore. So
cold.
Oh my God. It was fucking miserable. And yeah. I would always fall on the ice and snow. It was terrible. especially after I was drinking a lot. Ended up in Dallas it's almost 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's been like, I've been at Robert Lynn ever since.
Yep.
Craig Jones originally hired me, so I can thank him for getting me into the business. And then it's funny because I used to sit right outside your brother's office and I was so fucking scared. of Jeff for the first couple of weeks because he was loud and he was, you know, he'd make these snorting noises and it's just like, you didn't know what was going on between him and Rick Medina. It was kind of scary at first, but it was great. So it's been fun. And man, I've had opportunities to go other places and I've just never really strayed too far.
Yeah. So growing up in Beaumont, that's a pretty industrial town, huh?
I'd say it's it's very blue collar per se because of all the oil.
Yeah.
And I remember my parents telling me the story about when they first moved there, they were at dinner with some of their friends and they were asked how they liked Beaumont so far because they were from Kansas City. And my mom said, she goes, well, it smells real funny here. and it kind of does a little bit. It's kind of a weird, gross smell a little bit, but their friends looked at him and the guy's like, "That's what you call the smell of money."
Right.
So it was an industrial town. It was great. I grew up. My dad was in the uniform business, so I grew up kind of in the industrial realm of things, and was always really fascinated with warehouses because there's just so many different things that everyone does in them.
Yeah,
like you go into an office building, it's just everybody.
More office.
Yeah. It's just same shit.
Yeah.
Whereas you go in a warehouse, everyone's doing something different.
It's all different. That was kind of the coolest thing about being in, that's a cool, great thing about brokerage. You walk into all these places and see how everybody makes money. Different ways. Just ways you never even thought of too.
Well, so, I would have never thought like the pallet business was a big deal or like the recycled clothes business or the rag business.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy. Mm-hmm. And these are just super lucrative things that all these different people do.
So what made you want to go into commercial real estate?
So I wanted to go into commercial real estate because I did not want to be stuck behind a desk all day.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I worked at Marks & Millichap when I was in college, and that was like boiler room.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like cold calling on the phone.
So did you get to go through their cold calling gambit for a summer or something?
I had to like drive a guy's database, which wasn't too bad.
Yeah.
I mean, we've all done that already.
Yeah.
But I saw how like a lot of those guys operated and the fact that they were just in a desk, just dialing all day long.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is not what I want to do.
Yeah.
And so fortunately, my parents knew Craig Jones's parents and we made that connection. He introduced me to a bunch of people. And I would just come down here before I graduated over like a 2-day stint and talk to as many people as I could.
Yeah.
Like Rob Reiner, I talked to him, John Brewer. Who else? Well, obviously, Craig. But there were a bunch of other guys that I talked to as well. Lynn Murray, when he was at Vantage.
Yep.
So it was, I would just run the gauntlet of people. And then ultimately, the first time I interviewed at Robert Lynn, that I knew that was where I wanted to be.
Yeah.
But it took, I mean, I think like 4 or 5 trips down here before they finally.
After you took all your tests. God. They have a pretty intense.
Personality test.
Yeah.
And I won't lie, it made me a little nervous afterwards. I was like, I don't even know. Like, how do you even answer some of this stuff? Yeah. But it all worked out at the end of the day. So it's been a fun road up to this point.
Yeah.
There's been ups and downs, but it's been pretty good so far.
So you go to work with Craig, and Craig was kind of the king of South Dallas. Mm-hmm. And y'all are working down there, Redbird. Were y'all working all the way down into Wilmer and all that stuff yet? Or was that even a thing at that point when you started? That was just farmland, wasn't it?
A lot of it was. There were a couple buildings down there, and I started making calls down there. Mm-hmm. And actually, the very first building I ever sold was on I-45 down in Wilmer.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a big Tex AC building. It was like 15,000 square feet. I was so excited about that.
Yeah.
I think the commission on it was like 15 grand or something.
That was like huge to you back then.
It was totally huge.
Yeah.
So anyways, it was fun cold calling down there, down in Cedar Hill.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of fucking driving.
Yeah.
God, I think I put like 35 or 40,000 miles on my car the first year.
You know, when I was full-time broker and I was working Redbird too and all that stuff. And you know what? I finally came to the conclusion one day. I was like, I'm done working down here. I love it. I love the product. I love the buildings down there. I think Redbird's a great value. I think it's finally starting to see its value. You know what I mean? Like people overlooked it forever, but now it's starting to become a thing. But what I noticed was every time I called on an owner user that was the kind of the client that both of us kind of had was the local business owner user. They didn't live up in Dallas. They lived in Waxahachie. They lived in Ennis. So then you're going to tour buildings and freaking walk. They're like, hey, yeah, you know, I came up here because there was buildings, but like, I'd love to get a building closer to home. So then I'm in Brook Hollow and I got to go tour a building in Ennis. And I was like, my geography is getting too spread. And, man, it was a lot. And, so to your point, driving, like I literally finally just cut it off. I was like, because I had all of Brook Hollow, which you kind of divided like the bottom half of Brook Hollow out.
Yeah, basically where the Trinity Rail Express goes.
Yeah.
From there south.
Yeah. So for me, I had footage to go just take on. And I was just, in my mind, I was thinking, I was like, well, if Mosier and Clint Riley and all these guys are doing big production, then I just need to go take some of their production.
You know? Some of Jeff's.
Yes. Yeah. So, but yeah, the geography down there is very spread out. So.
It was crazy. So I was living in Uptown at the time, and I would go up to our office in North Dallas in the morning, mm-hmm. be up there till 8:39, and then I'd head straight south, either to like Brook Hollow or Mercantile, whatever you call it now.
Yep.
Turnpike, Pinnacle was just getting going at the time, mm-hmm. Lone Star, and then down to Redbird. I mean, I wouldn't go as far south as Waxahachie, but I mean, all on that whole I-20 corridor, and it was like, you go from North Dallas down there, and then at the end of the day, back up to North Dallas, and then back home.
Yeah,
I was like, "Holy shit!" I'm putting on like easily 100 miles a day.
It's funny when I made about the time I made the decision to quit working Redbird was about the time when I was making the decision to move my family, and I was like, "We might need to move to Midlothian, like for this to work."
It was so funny. Someone we moved houses. About 2 years ago, everyone's like, so where are y'all looking? Are y'all looking down like Mansfield or Midlothian or Cedar Hill? Like that way you can really just submerge yourself in the market. And I'm like, yeah, my wife would be not down with that.
Yeah. Oh, man. So you and Craig running around down there forever, you know, the South Dallas market to me was always like big deals, low velocity, but big deals. And, you know, it seemed like you and Craig pulled a number of those bigger ones off. And, and then I guess when did Craig leave and go to JLL?
So that was back in
It's almost like 10 years ago.
God, though, I kind of think it was almost 10 years ago.
Yeah,
I was actually just about to, it was about 8 years ago.
Okay.
So I was engaged at the time and we were probably about 6 months, 8 months out from getting married. So it was about 8 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So he left. That was probably a big shock for you.
Oh, dude, that was a complete shock. I remember I knew he had told me about it and I was just, it kind of threw me for a tailspin a little bit because mm-hmm. I wasn't expecting it. We had just come off like our worst year production wise. I mean, we were coming out like 2008, 2009.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And when he ultimately made his decision, he took me to a restaurant and told me, because I think he was real worried that I was just going to unlace a tirade of like, you motherfucker and like shits and goddams. But, and it was really hard for me at first. And I remember what's funny about that time is, I mean, within a week of him making that move, I had all these different people calling me, asking me if I wanted to do something different or go someplace different. And my ultimate goal at Robert Lynn was to be a principal.
Mm-hmm.
And I ultimately knew that's where I was going to stay.
Yeah.
But I was open to talking to somebody. Like I talked to, you know, some guys at CB, to Casey Jones, and because he had always been super great to me.
Yeah.
And I had a ton of respect for him. And he and I talked for a little bit and I couldn't really drag him out just because of how well he had treated me in the past. So I ultimately just talked to George and Mark and where they were like, this is what it's going to take. So, and that was the decision I made.
Yeah.
So it was not hard. It was just hard dealing with the situation at the time.
Yeah. No, you know, it's a, you see guys go to other shops and it takes them 6 months to a year to like get it all going, you know? So there's a big lag in that stuff too. And, you know, I mean, there's money to be had on the other side of it, I'm sure. I don't know. I never got recruited by anybody. I think they all assumed that I had an ownership of Mercer Company. So like no one ever like called me once. So they're probably just scared of Jeff.
I'll call you now just to make you feel better.
I'll tell you what. The only person that tried to recruit me was Chase Miller. He's like, come on, dude. Come on. Come broker with me. We'll kill Brook Hollow. I was like, you're already killing it. It's like, what do you want me to do?
Drive you around?
Yeah.
Have you ever ridden in the car with him?
No, I'm sure.
It is fucking scary.
Oh, I bet. It's
like, he's got his knee steering the car and he's like texting and talking at the same time. It's kind of scary.
He needs to get a driver.
He needs to come do this with you.
He already has.
He has?
Yeah. He was like probably the third guest.
Oh, I bet he was really intense.
He was good. I want to do it again with him and get him drunk.
I think that would be pretty entertaining.
Yeah.
I don't know if you can get him to sit still though if he's drinking.
We can take breaks.
Okay.
So we'll have mixed breaks. We'll mix up a new one.
So Chase Miller is the only person that tried to recruit you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's not a bad.
No. I was like, man, my ship has sailed. I go, you don't want me as a partner. I'm not going to work as hard as you do anymore. I used to do that, but not anymore.
He would get mad at you for not showing up at 5 a.m.
Yeah, no, I know. I was like, I know what you expect, and I don't got that no more. So,
a funny Chase Miller story is, I guess it was probably the second week he started at Robert Lynn. I used to get there at like 4:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
Because I would go downstairs and work out. I'd come get my day going and then go downstairs and work out. And I got there one day at like 4:45 or something. And he was already there and he put this post-it note on my desk and it said, Chase 1, Matt 0. And I took it. I remember going into his office and I was like, listen, motherfucker. When you've been doing this for like 15 years.
Yeah.
And you're still getting here that early, then you can start writing post-it notes. But for now, just keep them to yourself. So,
I was, me and my daughter went to a Mavs game on a Sunday one time, and I'm driving back from the Mavs game, going up the toll road, fixing to be at 6:35. I get an email from Chase. I just call him. It's like Sunday at 5:00. I go, are you literally in your office right now? He goes, oh, yeah. I was like, I was driving by it and you sent this email. So I just kind of figured I'd just call you. So
he always does that. He doesn't do it as much anymore.
Yeah.
Which
getting
is
getting soft, Chase.
Oh,
just getting soft.
talk about that. Tell him how soft he is. He gets real offended by that. Anybody listening, if you want to get under Chase's skin, just tell him that he's soft.
He's pretty soft. So, he's ultra competitive. He sold us a couple deals though. Owns a couple deals with us. He's
awesome.
He's great to work with, man. Like, it's just very real quick and to the point. We try to answer him really quickly so that he can, because he's got 10 dudes in line to take a deal from him. And so, you know, unfortunately, he works Brook Hollow primarily. So, like, I don't really buy him Brook Hollow. I can't
compete.
I can't compete.
And, it's shocking. Like, you were talking about Redbird and what's happened down there. Yeah. Like, you go, I remember when in Brook Hollow, when buildings were like 25.
Yeah.
And like $30 a foot.
I've sold buildings in the teens before in Brook Hollow.
That feels like it was like decades ago, but it wasn't.
No, it wasn't that long ago. It's probably 10 years ago.
I mean, I remember when Jeff owned buildings down the design district that he bought for like $10 a foot.
I remember one time Jeff had 3 buildings on Levy Street he could have bought for $13 a foot. And Mr. Lynn told him he was overpaying. So he didn't buy them. You know what's crazy about design district though? So I remember when I started in the business in 2010 and I looked back, I remember at that time the vacancy rate in Redbird was like 17%. It was pretty high. Yeah. It was pretty high. You know what was interesting though? I was looking at the vacancy rate in the design district in 2019, I think, when the market was pretty hot. It was like 17-18%.
I feel like the turnover over there has got to be insane because it feels like it's almost like a pseudo retail market now.
Yeah, it is. I remember, what got me going to go to Redbird was like my first or second week of making cold calls. I got to Design District and it was like 8:30 in the morning.
No one's there.
I was like, I'm out. Like, I was like, I need real businesses. This seems like a bunch of hobby businesses and stuff like that.
If you're ever stuck on 35 at like 8 a.m. or 8:30, just go through the design district. Yeah. It'll be the quickest commute.
It's a ghost town. So
it's crazy.
I was like, this isn't real industrial to me. And I could see the change that was happening with it. I was like, I'm not going to be able to tell a guy that, you know, oh yeah, this is an art. You know, museum or whatever, studio or whatever, like, you know, a gallery. That's what it is.
Like, I can just picture you and your brother and like Robert Blankenship going space down there.
You know, it's funny. Jeff had success down there. I was like, I don't see this as being for me. So, I ended up in Redbird. I was like, I went back to Jeff's office and I was like, hey, can I go to Redbird? I feel like this isn't real businesses to me. And,
You know what's so funny to me about Redbird is I remember when I started, there was like not really any competition down there. No. Like no one cold called down there. It was like me, Craig, Adam Graham, Ken Wesson, some.
Yeah, that was probably very sparse too.
And that was it.
And that was probably Adam Graham and Kim were probably more Pinnacle Turnpike.
Yeah, they totally were. But they did some down there.
Scatter shoot down there a little bit.
And now it's like, I mean, I feel like there's a handful of guys that really worked that market pretty hard.
Yeah.
Which is funny because, I mean, for the longest time, I felt like we had a little bit of a monopoly on it, but it's definitely changed in the last couple of years.
Yeah. No, it's, it's funny. The most production I did in Redbird was the year after I quit working Redbird. I was like, damn. Because everybody, you know, I established some brand down there and just everybody starts calling and all that.
I bet it takes probably, what would you say, 4 or 5 years to really kind of get traction?
Yeah, because it, like I said, it's slow velocity down there.
And most people won't even talk to you. I mean, you got to cold call them on like 20, 30 times before they even get a response.
Yeah, no.
And usually it's like, quit leaving your shit here.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We're never moving, And let's talk about like the evolution of South Dallas, because that's kind of been a big topic down into the Wilmer area. You know, I started creeping down there. I've done a couple leases down there, but all the building down there, now you have all these Class A tilt walls down there. What does that look like now?
It is, what's crazy to me about South Dallas is I remember 15 years ago, I would tell people, I'm like, it's going to happen down in South Dallas. I mean, you're you go from 45 and 20 or 35 and 20 to downtown, mm-hmm. and you're there in 10, 15 minutes max.
Right.
I mean, you maybe go to the Galleria and you try to go south and you get downtown in 15 minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy just how close it really is to downtown.
Yeah.
And the funny thing about South Dallas is no one wanted to go down there for so long. I mean, you look at some of the big developers, I mean, Trammell Crow, Hillwood, all these big guys, for years, no one would even touch it. And then all of a sudden, Hillwood went down there, and then Prologis went down there, and First Industrial, and it was just like, boom, off to the races. Duke.
Yep.
I mean, and then after that, 2008, 2009, it kind of stopped for a little bit.
Yep.
And then once Allen Group, kind of all their bankruptcy stuff got settled, it was just crazy. I mean, I can't remember the last time there were so many out-of-town developers that had a big presence in South Dallas.
You know, I did like a study. There was a developer that I knew, and they wanted to come to Dallas, and they wanted to look at land sites. And, you know, when I studied like the Wilmer, South Dallas area, I said, man, I think if you're going to come develop down here, I think you got to have the balls to put up 1 million feet.
See, it's so funny because I feel like that's how everyone thinks down there. And you look right now, I mean, all the million footers that are sitting down there vacant.
Yeah.
I feel like the sweet spot down there is if you can find someone that can do a good 200,000-300,000 square foot building and multi-tenant it.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at what the vacancy rate on that type of stuff, it's like significantly
multi-tenant lower. To like a 25 or a 30. Like, there's nothing like that down
there's
there.
There's nothing. I mean, there's a couple buildings. There's one over on 45, a couple on Langdon, Dallas Avenue.
Yeah.
And then some over on Houston School Road. But I mean, that tenant base, those buildings stay full.
I couldn't figure out, though. I was like, I think you either you do something like that, or you do a million footer at the time. This was before, really. This was probably 2017, 2018. And I was like, because all these, like, I think if you do like a 500, someone's going to go, not big enough. And then a lot of people are going to be like, it's too big. Like, it's like, I feel like that in between space down there, call it 350 to 750, is you might just be sitting around for a while.
I still think obviously right now there's a lot of that type of space available. Yeah. But I mean, it was so funny because I think Hillwood was the first one. They did the 500.
Mm-hmm.
And then Prologis did one that was about 500,000-600,000 too. And at the time, those buildings were, I mean, that was the equivalent of a million footer today.
Yeah.
And now it's like, I mean, a million footer is just kind of the norm. It's
the
new
normal, yeah. No.
Which is fun.
So what is it? There's like 13 million feet available down there or something?
It's a lot. I mean, but the irony of that whole situation is you lease 2-3 of those buildings, and all of a sudden that vacancy rate gets whacked real fast.
Yeah.
So, and it's funny, there's either a ton of them or there's none of them.
Right. All right. No. Well, you know, that's where the land was too.
Yep.
So, you know, there wasn't much left as far as infill sites or anything like that. And so the land is available. The money was available. I always say development wasn't done on a supply and demand basis. It was done on the cost of capital. Capital, and capital was cheap when all these buildings went up. So
I would say that is 100% true. I mean, you look at what happened once interest rates started going up, that like the construction down there just like stopped.
Yeah.
Anyone that was already under construction finished, but nothing else started.
Yeah. And they probably had pre-purchased their materials and then, you know, pre-bought. And so, well, okay. This is something I always like to ask. What was your most awkward cold call you ever made?
So the most awkward cold call. Oh man, it was a company. They're no longer in business. It was a company called Adventure Graphics. They're over on Halifax.
Yep.
And I'd probably been making cold calls for 8 months. 9 months at this point, and it was July or August, and it was a Friday, and it was like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I still remember this. My air conditioner had just gone out on my piece of shit car that I had after college, which we all had. Yeah. And my buddies were already like leaving work and going to start drinking, and I was still fucking cold calling on Halifax.
Yep. The worst street.
Which at the time was the worst street, it felt like. And I walk into this place, Adventure Graphics, and I ask for this guy. And they're like, well, he's dead. I'm like, oh my God. I'm hot. I'm like tired. I just, at this point, I'm just kind of like beaten down by the day. And I was like, okay, well, who's running things now? And anyways, well, the woman, she says, well, the guy he asked for is dead. His partner's here. I don't know if he'll talk to you though. So ultimately she goes back and he says that I can come back and talk to him. But it was just one of those days when it was just like asking for someone that's dead.
Yeah.
It's like, how do you even come back for that? I mean, and it's funny because now in hindsight, you know, any new guy, I'm like, how long is it going to take before you ask for a dead guy? but it was just, that was probably the most awkward cold call.
Yeah, man. So one time when I was just starting the business, Jeff was like, hey, I'm going to go make cold calls with you. I'm like, okay. And you know the guy. I can't remember the name of his business. He was he was right there on, I think it was Bronze. And he did the stainless steel kitchen fabricator guy in that building. Oh, yeah,
Classic Stainless.
Yeah, Classic Stainless. Anyways, I'm in there talking to him. And at the time, I guess his son had just passed away.
Okay.
And he tells us that in the middle, at the very beginning of the meeting. And then on Duncanville Road, there was the, they were doing construction on the road. And you know, so as we go along in our conversation, he started talking about the construction on the road. He goes, man, again, it started off with the first, like, hey, my son just passed away and all this stuff. And it was like,
Bill Newton.
Yeah. Bill Newton. Yeah. That's right. And we kind of got past that, you know, and then we're talking about the street. And he goes, man, these people I don't know where they learned to drive. And then Jeff goes, you know where I learned to drive? He goes, where? He goes, the cemetery. And I was like, oh my God, did you just say that? We walk out of there. I go, dude.
Jeff's like, you're going to do a deal with that guy.
Yeah. I go, did you not catch the part where his son just passed away and you start talking about a cemetery? He goes, no, I didn't hear him say that. I go, all right, that's it. You're done making cold calls. You're retired. No more cold calls with me.
Was that the first time you went to make cold calls? Or was that the first time he went with you?
This is only the first time he went with me.
Oh, my God. So, you know what's funny about that guy? I don't even know how this came up, but it's funny you brought him up. I was like redoing my house when I was single or something. I forgot what it was, but I was getting rid of like a bunch of furniture. And like two of the things I was getting rid of, like typical single person, were two leather Lazy Boys. And somehow it got brought up on when I was talking to Bill Newton about that. And he's like, well, I'll buy those. And so he ended up buying two leather Lazy Boys from me, which was kind of funny.
Yeah. No. Well, and then you were talking about Halifax Street earlier. You know, for people that don't know, Halifax Street was probably literally the worst street in Dallas. Like it
sucked.
It looked like it had been it looked like a bombed road in Baghdad.
You literally needed four-wheel drive just to drive down it. If you had a car, you were going
to
bottom out.
So I went to Westway Ford in Irving Toyota of Irving to test drive a car one time. And he goes, all right, let's go out. Now, why don't you take this route? I go, no, sir. We're going to Halifax Street. I took this car salesman to Halifax Street. I was, goosh, goosh, goosh. I was like, I got to see if this works. I drive this street like every day.
And then you said, nope, don't want it. Yeah, don't want it.
Going to need a truck. Need a bigger suspicion. So, all right. Well, this is something else I always like to ask. What was like the most complex, like unique, like deal that you pulled off that was like one of the coolest deals you've ever done? And, you know, maybe like multiple sales situation, or you landed the tenant and the building sale all at the same time? And
so I would say I'm gonna go back to the probably the beginning. And there's a company, it's now called Pout Logistics.
Yep.
And I think it was Pout Logistics at the time. There's a guy named Kevin Summers down on Ledbetter Drive.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I cold called on that guy forever and I couldn't ever see him. I mean, a part of me is like, does this guy even exist?
Yeah. I don't think I ever met him. I cold called him forever. He
doesn't see anybody. Well, ultimately, I get back to my office one day and he calls me up, or I have a voicemail from him and I return his call. He's like, hey, we need like 20,000 square feet for just 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time I was like, man, this is my shot.
Yeah.
I've got to make it work. Mm-hmm. And we ultimately found something that would work for him. And then he said, hey, you know, I want you to meet my new partner, Jim Schwab. And so I got to know Jim. He was over on Union Bower at the time because mm-hmm. they had just bought another pallet company. And their ultimate plan was to consolidate into one operation. And we had looked at 4,100 Platinum Way, and they had put it under contract. And the funny thing about that building is I thought I was going to get shanked in that building one day because I went down there because we were selling it at the time. But I went down there to show it, and someone said the water was like leaking out of the building. So I just went down there to check on it. I didn't tell anyone where I was going or what I was doing. And I walk in one side of the building and I can hear something like it was 185,000 feet. So it's a big building. So I get in about halfway and like a dude pops out.
Yeah.
And I asked him what he was doing there. And I said probably a bunch of other stuff that I regret saying or shouldn't have said. And then two other dudes pop out with pipes in their hands. And I was like, oh shit. I was like, this just went from fucking bad to worse. And I remember thinking in my head, I'm like, no one knows where the fuck I am right now.
Yep.
And I'm going to like, these guys are going to fucking kill me. And I just backtracked out of the building the whole time thinking someone's about to come up behind me and hit me. And this is it. Well, I got out of there. But anyways, these guys had just vandalized the hell out of this building.
Mm-hmm.
And so Jim and Kevin went and looked at it and they were both like, what a piece of shit. But this is great for a pallet business.
Yeah.
And so they put it under contract. They ultimately couldn't make the numbers work. And then George Musa bought it.
Mm-hmm.
Still owns
it.
Yeah, won't sell it.
Won't sell it.
No, never going to sell it, probably.
Mm-mm.
And Nathan Denton and Brett Owens had sold it to him because they've worked with George forever.
Okay, so that's the connection.
That's the connection.
Okay, because anyways, keep going.
And so Craig walks into my office one day and he's like, hey, you're going to probably get a call from Nathan Denton or Brett Owens today.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, I was talking to him about it because I knew that he knew that George had the building under contract. So sure enough, I get a call from them. And we all meet. It's me, Nathan, Brett, George Musa, and Jim Schwab. And we basically put together this lease deal at the building.
Yeah.
On everything that needed to be done and kind of what their whole plan was, what they were going to do. And George and Jim really hit it off pretty well.
Yeah.
And so that we ended up making that deal. And that was the first deal, like really, I felt like big deal that I ever made.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just fun because
that was a 10-year lease, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was a 10-year lease.
Yeah, I remember that deal. That deal got done like as soon as I got in the business. I was like, damn, that's a big deal.
Yeah, I wish I could have done like 20 of those like every year. Mm-hmm. But it was fun because it sucked that they had to drop the contract. But it ultimately, the way we were able to put it all back together worked out like perfect. And Nathan and Brett were awesome to work with. George was awesome.
Now, wasn't Nathan repping Kevin Summers at one point too?
So, yes. Okay. He had...
Because he was selling Kevin's building.
Correct. He tried to at one point.
He didn't get it done. No. I think you were the second up.
So, we ended up bringing the tenant, Meinhark. Mm-hmm.
Meinhark, yeah.
Yeah, they ended up
taking it. I've worked with Meinhark too.
So we did that deal and then Kevin ultimately was like, look, you've been down here more than any other person. So
yeah.
So he gave me a chance. But it was fun working with Nathan and Brett, and I got to know those guys really well, and that was fun.
So it's funny. I was George has this building on Calvert. You probably know the building he has. And I put the last tenant in there.
That's an awesome building.
That building's incredible. It's like
it's got a yard.
Oh man, that building is like if I could have 10 of those, like give me 10 of those, and I'll see you later. And I put the tenant in there last time, and the same tenant, different. The guy, my client, he's a guy I have in Brook Hollow. I got him in like 5 buildings across Brook Hollow, but he kind of sets up these companies for people and runs them and all this stuff. Anyways, he had another need. I was like, I knew Calvert was coming available, and I was like, George, hey, let's work this deal and all that stuff. And he hadn't listed it yet. And I was like, hey, and like, again, I don't take many listings. Like I took Halifax, right? Because I knew I'd transact Halifax fast. And, you know, here we are going into title today, right? And so...
Did they sign that yet?
No, I just sent it out this morning. So it should get signed. That was my fault yesterday. I was like at 5. I sent it at like 7 a.m. and I was like... And then at 5, I was like, no one's responding to this. And my site's pretty responsive. So I go back into my email. I saw it was a draft. But anyways, so... George, I was like, George, look, even if it doesn't work with him, I brought the tenant last time. You hired Stream last time. Don't hire Stream. Like, I was like, give me a shot. Like, I want the, like, I like this building. I want to list this building. And he's like, oh, well, you know, all this stuff. I go, don't make me the bridesmaid. Come on, man. Like, he's like, well, I got to give it to Nathan and Brett. You know, I just, you know, and I was like, why? Like, I go, I'm just a bridesmaid. I'm always a bridesmaid to you, but I'll bring you your tenant. And he goes, no, you're the bride right now. I go, yeah, with one deal.
It sucks. It sucks when it's like us hearing that, but yeah. At the same time, it's like, man, I got to respect like the loyalty.
Oh, yeah. I like George a lot. It was great. We actually toured the building the other day with George and he showed up. And that's why, my client, he had sold his company to a big publicly traded company out of Europe. And we're in an institutionally owned building right now on Regal Row building you sold. And this new owner is just like super institutional. It's super, I mean, you can't get anything done, right? And I was telling the guy at, I was really just trying to move him based on principle, honestly.
T-Hub.
Yeah, there's T-Hub. And I was like, I go, listen, I don't know how this would go, but like we can literally make a deal in the parking lot with George. It'll go real easy. So, and I go, he's literally one street over. If you need anything, he'll just, and so he came and just toured us through the building.
I wish every owner was that like easy. You know, just like gets it and he's just, I mean, he'll just cut a deal right there.
Yeah. You know, I'll tell you one thing we've been doing here lately is like, I try to get the listing broker or whoever's repping us to be like, get me a meeting with the owner.
Yeah.
And like, if I get in a room with an owner, there's a 99% chance we're closing that deal.
Because that's all they want to do is deal with who the ultimate decision maker is. They don't want to deal with some shyster broker.
Right. So to that point, like I was like, hey, look, we can make a deal in the parking lot with George. These guys, and they're in like Boston or something. I was like, this will take, every email you send will take a week to get a response. It's unbelievable, you know? And he asked me, my tenant asked me, he goes, why are these guys so slow? I go, it's not their money.
No.
They're just managing people's money. They don't care. They don't have any money in it. Like, but George, this is like George's baby. Like, he wants to get the deal done.
Didn't he start his company in that building?
He might have. And then he has the best buildings in Brook Hollow, probably.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Like, no doubt.
So,
the building where his company is right now, I think he bought that building for like 10 bucks a foot.
It's probably worth 180 a foot.
Well, it's crazy. It was the old Midas building.
Yeah. That building's awesome.
Dude, it is awesome.
I mean, if you need 100 in Brook Hollow with clear height, that's it.
Yeah.
So
that might be, I mean, it's either that or buildings over on Mockingbird. And they have a shared truck court.
Right. But freestanding, single tenant, I mean, that building right there would be incredible. So, but, you know, anyways, that does help. Just having someone that's attentive, an owner that's attentive and ready to make a deal and can just kind of get over some bullshit. You know, they're not having to go ask an attorney every time, you know, but I remember I remember sitting in George's office and he had all the plans to Platinum Way. Like, I mean, it took him a year to get that thing put back together. Oh, I think
it was crazy what a fucking mess that building was. Mm-hmm. I mean, those guys had ripped out like all the copper plumbing, flooded the offices. I mean, it literally had to be turned back into a shell.
Didn't Alan Gump have the listing? Was Alan Gump involved in that somehow?
You know what? He may actually have had the listing.
I felt like he...
Because, God, who was... Jeff Howell owned that building. I think he ultimately had to give the keys back to the bank. And then the bank gave the listing, I think, to Alan Gump. I think that's exactly right.
Yeah. I remember his sign on it, driving my valuables.
And they used to put dogs. They had dogs in that building. Mm-hmm.
The dog. There's a dog guy. He'll come in and bring your dogs in at night,
which
and
is
he'll pick them up in the morning.
Which is just fucking gross. Because they shit all over the place. I mean, imagine showing a building telling people, hey, watch out for the dog shit in the building.
Yeah. That's, you know what I thought was funny? It was during COVID. Everybody started doing these online videos, you know? And like, even I saw ML made a video, and they probably did everything you're supposed to do to the building to make it look good. But it's an old, it's a used industrial building.
Yeah.
It just doesn't look pretty.
No.
You know? So yeah, dog shit on top of that would be. So, all right. Well, I think I know the answer to this, but what do you think is kind of the thing that always allows you to succeed and win? Like what's your regular go-to thing that you do during the week and, or, you know, your ritual or whatever, what is it that, you know,
I would say, well, honestly, I'd probably say like working out is probably I feel like I do that every day, and that's kind of like how I get my day going. It's funny, the older I've gotten, I used to work out in the afternoons before I'd go home, and then it was at lunch, and then during COVID, it just switched to the mornings.
Yeah.
And now, and maybe that's like, I'll blame it on COVID, but I'll just also say it's probably because I'm getting older.
Yeah.
But I'd say that's the go-to, and it's really like starting my day doing the same thing that I've always done for 20 years, which is like, just lay out my entire day and plan out everything and look at what I have and decide where I'm going to make cold calls.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny because now making cold calls is almost like therapeutic. Whereas for years, it got to be fucking old, and it just like would wear you down. And now it's fun because you don't get to do it as much, or you can't make as many.
Yeah, you can't do it. And then, but people will see you now.
Yes.
They're like, you know, that's what, you know, I was telling Will the other day. I was like, well, you know, I can't make as many cold calls anymore because everyone usually answers now.
Yeah.
You know,
or they return your call.
They return your call. So you're busy just kind of constantly doing that. And, that's what, you know, I'm starting to kind of do more cold calls on the capital raising side now, but I'm taking the same mentality to it, you know, of, you know.
Is that the same? Like,
it's
different. Like, it's a different menu, but is it like, Is it the same as it was when you're calling on 10 or 15,000 square foot users?
I think the good thing, the better thing about it is everybody's interested. Whereas a guy might not make a real estate decision for 10 years and he doesn't care to really talk to you. But when you know, now that we have track record and stuff like that, when I call a family office, I'm like, hey, this is what we're doing. These are some people that invested with us, da 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 da. I'd love to just come sit down with you and show you what we're doing.
Have you gotten to the point where you've been able to tell people, like, I don't want to work with you anymore?
Well, what we're doing now is I used to kind of take any check I could get from anybody. Now I'm just going, hey, look, it's time to go programmatic. Like, I'm going to buy 10 deals. I need to put you down for a minimum of 50 a deal. And if that doesn't work for you, hey, man. Sorry.
I'll get you on the next one.
I'll get you if we get a big raise together on a bigger deal, then, you know, I might put it on the portal, but that's kind of how I've gone to. We're starting this, our debt fund. And so I've been kind of having these conversations with my investors one-on-one, be like, hey, look, we're raising a debt fund. It's these kind of products and vehicles, and then we'll still do value add stuff. But on that side, I need you to give me, so the fund is a fund commitment, and this side is kind of like a fund. I can dial you back and down every now and then because we have programmatic equity partners now, larger partners, but I'm like, but I don't want to like call people for $50,000 checks. I want you to say, hey, I'm in for $500,000 and I'll put you down $50,000 per deal.
I feel like a lot of those guys will just say yes because they know that you're going to just, if they say no, you're just going to the next guy and he'll probably do it.
Yeah. No, they have.
And, it's like Chase Miller with taking you a building.
Yeah. No, it's right. He just goes the next dude.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of where we've gotten, and we're just having those conversations. You know, I'm like, hey, you know, I think we've kind of proved our theory here, and you know, we've made some great returns for everybody, and you know, we know what we're doing. And so now a lot of my calls, I honestly think our debt fund side of things is going to be bigger than the value add stuff down the road.
Yeah.
And so what I'm doing is I've got a good bit of that raised, but I'm really going to start making calls for fund two now, even though we haven't even opened the first fund. But I could see I need to make the relationships now with people that, you know, fund one is going to be 25 million. Fund two in my mind could be 100 million. And I need to be having those conversations now to be in front of people to be like, hey, I'm on fund two. Here's how fund one's doing. You want to get into fund two.
What's funny to me is how those funds, I mean, it's just like some of the guys that have done them and the product they buy and the returns they give, I'm like, Jesus Christ.
Well, like, that's why I don't like funds on value add side, because I feel like it forces you to go buy a deal.
Yeah.
And they buy bad deals just to get the money allocated out. on the debt side, it's kind of great because I get to fund everybody's deal. And it's like, okay, well, I'll just pick and choose. And those are really just more like for preferred equity for like a, you know, someone building a triple net lease, retail, single tenant deal, you know, and those, there's tons of those. So I think the scalability of this side is a lot greater.
Are you buying retails?
I'm not buying it. I'm the equity on it.
Oh.
So like we, you know, we funded some Murphy's fuel stations. We funded a Tom Thumb. We have like three Circle K's. We're fixing a fund. But we're just the equity. We have a sponsor. We find a sponsor. We kind of vet him. We vet his business plan. And then we raise the equity and put it into him. And, you know, we make close to like a 18 to 20% effective yield.
Oh my God.
And I don't have to do anything. Like, I don't have to go get
kicked.
You don't
have to manage or do anything.
I just got to watch him, you know, and just get updates from him. But half the time, some of these tenants, they're ground leases. So they're built. I'm relying on a publicly traded company to build their building. Well, that's going to happen. Like, is, you know what I mean? I have a signed lease at closing, you know, a 20-year lease signed at closing. Like, okay, what's the worst that happens? I just start, and I have controls over the operator. Like, hey, man, if you run into some life problems and screw it all up, I can step in and take over and finish out construction or finish out management or take over the books or whatever I need to do. And
so would you ever do like office?
Do any office.
I feel like that's just a losing deal.
I don't think it's done yet either. I haven't heard anybody say this, but my thought on office is this. Before COVID, how many multi-plate 10-year leases were signed? You know, like a ton, right? We're only into 2014 right now of 10-year leases being signed. COVID is 6 years down the road from 2014, right? So like, so think about it, like Children's Medical Center, they have like 7 floors at Trinity Towers. When those leases rolls, they ain't keeping 7 floors. Dude, there's going to be...
Think about what Stennis Corridor is going to look like with the office space once some of those tenants move out.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I mean, when Stennis Tower just sold, they're going to redevelop that into apartments, you know? But I mean, like, I don't think office takes a full shit until past 2030.
I just feel like office... You know what's funny? Speaking of office, like office brokers that are trying to get into an industrial stuff, mm-hmm. that always kind of makes me laugh. Because you can just pick them out. They're so intense. They're so
pretty.
Well, they're arrogant.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're just not fun.
No.
They just don't.
Very sharp elbows.
They don't have the bullshit.
No. Well, they're, you know, they're the perfect human being, right? They, you know, they got the best hair and they got abs and they look the best in a suit and all these things and stuff we weren't built for. I don't know. I think office is nowhere close to being waxed yet. Like,
I thank God that we're in industrial like every single day.
We had a bank bring us a 220,000 foot Class A office right up here on Legacy, right next to Legacy West. We could buy the note for $66 a foot.
And I was, oh my God!
But like,
that'd be like a cheap industrial deal,
dude. That's like what I paid for metal buildings in Sigaville.
Oh.
And I
you wouldn't touch it.
I wouldn't touch it. I called some bigger players and I was like, hey, do y'all want to buy this? Like, I ain't touching it. Like, I'm
$66 a foot. Mm-hmm. Oh my God.
But man, office is so capital intensive too. Like, I mean, you got to just rip everything apart every time someone moves. I mean, the finish out. I mean,
shit breaks all the time. It's a fucking mess.
Yeah. I got no interest in it. And, no, we'll do in the fund. We'll do, you know, we'll do some house flipper loans or something like that. So we'll do first lien. We'll do pref equity. We'll do, you know, but a big focus is going to be, you know, net lease, retail, single tenant developments and kind of the smaller check size. I call it 3 million and under on the check size. And then, you know, we've done some first lien industrial already for, you know, the guy we both know, he bought a property and did it on a tax lien and bought a tax lien. And he was like, hey, I had to put all my cash into this. Can you cash me out while I wait for redemption period to go through? So yeah. And he had great basis in it. So I gave him 100% loan on it. And, you know, I think once we get out there and start telling people, hey, we can be your debt, we'll be your bridge lender on a lot of things. You know, we'll do 2-year notes for you.
I think that's huge, especially right now, just because the cost of capital and banks are just, I mean, hell, they're even retrading you at the closing table.
Banks are really finicky right now.
Yeah.
I feel like they over the summer, they were totally out of the game. I feel like lately they've gotten back in the game, but now with the inflationary numbers, I feel like they're kind of getting back on the sidelines again.
Oh, I think they totally are, and it's just going to make everyone more cautious.
Yeah, it's and banks are really funny. They you know, now banks are really gunning for your deposits. And so for anybody listening out there, let me tell you about getting my deposits. Getting a person's deposits is the biggest ass whip on that person for zero benefit. To move all your banking to another bank is like just getting kicked in the ass all day long.
Well, then they just tell you what you want to hear. And then you get over there and it's like, what the fuck was this all about?
So we had a bank. We closed two deals with them on the same day on a Friday. And man, they were pushing hard for my deposits. And I was like, I ain't doing it. You'll get the deposit for this loan, for this, the operating account for this property, but you're not getting my deposits. Come Monday, I call them. I was like, well, hey, I got another deal. They go, oh, well, we're done lending on commercial real estate now. So now when all these banks are like, hey, we want your deposits, I go, that's great. What's my legal lending limit with you? And they'll be like, oh, you know, it could be 15 million, 20 million. That's great. You have the CEO sign a letter right now that guarantees me that much runway with your bank. And we'll talk about my deposits.
They go, has anybody done it?
No, they can't do that. They're like, oh, we can't do this. I go, then why would I do this? Why would I do that? You can't even guarantee me you can be my provider, you know? And because these banks, you know, they'll shut off lending on commercial real estate right now, like in overnight. Like you'll show up the next day and they're like, oh yeah, hey, we don't do this anymore.
Do you think there's going to be any fallout from some of these loans that were done 5, 6 years ago? 4 years ago on these crazy cap rates, or do you think they'll just refinance them?
I think banks.
They'll just sell them.
They'll sell them. Banks will refinance them. People will capital call them. I think the biggest problem is going to be the biggest problems are going to be in the office and multifamily loans.
Oh, no doubt.
Like there's multifamily has a lot of rent pressure on it right now. Multifamily, especially like in Texas, the insurance rates have gone up significantly. And it's not like they pass that on to the tenant. They're in a lease. They're in a gross lease with the tenant that has no pass-through. So they have to try to re-up it whenever the lease rolls.
Yeah.
But they have to stay competitive with the market. And so it's not like an industrial where obviously we try to keep our insurance costs down because it does no benefit for us to pay more, or the tenant to pay more. But at the end of the day, it's some form of triple net structure, whether it's a gross lease to the base year or a true triple net lease.
God, they're going to start doing apartment triple net leases.
They might. I mean, like
I mean, can you imagine?
I mean, my CPA, they raise money and put money into deals. And, he said they have an apartment complex in Houston and their insurance renewal wiped out their NOI.
I can imagine.
You know? And so, I think you're going to see a lot of pressure, you know, a lot of the apartment syndicators, they took all this floating rate debt, you know? And so, and it's just not, the tide's not coming back in on that stuff right now. And, so, you know, what we did this probably last summer. We went through the exercise. We took all of our debt maturities, marked it up to 10% interest, and saw what our debt service coverage ratio was on it at when what our estimated NOI was when that loan would mature. And I think we only had like 5 assets that were going to be under a 1.25.
That's not bad.
No, I thought it was great.
That's not bad at all.
I sent it
like,
to my
I would take that.
Yeah. My bank was like, hey, man, this looks great. You know?
Didn't loan me more money.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what, I mean, that's, so now when we apply for a new loan with somebody, we send that to them. Say, hey, here's all of our assets. Here's a mark to market of 10% interest on our deals. And these are stabilized deals. We can get better. We can totally beat 10%. You know what I mean? But at that same time too, we might have more equity built in the deal where, you know, you refinance it at that time. And so anyways, I think we're going to be fine with that. I think most industrial operators are going to be okay because they've caught so much rent growth, you know?
Oh, the rent growth is crazy.
Yeah. I think rents are going to kind of start softening now or just kind of just stop going up. Like,
I feel like it's going to stop going up at a certain size range.
Yeah.
On like the smaller stuff, I'd say like sub 75,000 square feet. Yeah. I don't think it may not.
It might not. The bigger box stuff, they're going to have to make some deals and just get it done. But, and I think some of those bigger deals, I think you might start seeing some users being able to pick those off and buy them.
I think you are starting to even just see those guys out in the market now, which is crazy that a user would need 1 million feet or even 700,000 square feet. Right. Like, how do you even operate that?
You sell that to someone else that wants to operate it. So, but I think, I think rates will, I mean, we got to get through this year, but you know, man, we've been very effective at getting owner financing. You know, I think 6 of our last 7 deals have had owner financing in them.
I think owners will look at doing it, especially if it's someone that they like, they have an existing relationship with or who has some credibility behind them. I think they totally will. I mean, you can get 6.5%, which is a guaranteed return.
Yeah. Or, I mean, look at the deal we bought.
Yeah.
We got a year, no payments and 5%.
I mean, that is it's crazy.
It's crazy, you know? And but I think the big thing that people see with that is we're putting 35 to 40% down. So they're like, hey, I'm getting a good rip. I can pay the brokers. I can walk with some cash, you know? And the NOI that I was getting, because I've been under leasing my building forever, is pretty much the same as the mortgage payments. So now I can just step into the lender position and I just jam the basis down on an asset I already know. So if I have to take it back, what's the big deal?
I think you'll even see guys that'll start to refinance and just keep doing that.
Yeah.
Like that same guy may do the same thing in another year because he knows that he can't go get anything anywhere else.
Yeah. No, I think that's part of our debt fund. I want to tell brokers, be like, hey, look, if you find someone that needs owner financing and the seller won't do it, call us. We'll step in and be like a more creative lender on the deal, you know? So
I think that's great.
And that's where I've ended up in a lot of situations. Like, you know, the buildings we own and, you know, they're like, hey, I can't get a loan. I'm like, well, okay, well, I'll owner finance it to you.
Well, I feel like you've like hit a sweet spot though, because you go after the stuff that, you know, the institutional guys won't necessarily, they don't want to fuck with.
Yeah.
But then when you package it up and sell it, they totally want to look at it.
Yeah.
I mean, they kind of, it's like, oh, we don't want to get our hands dirty in this stuff yet.
Yeah. No. So yeah, we'll go do the work. We'll go take the trash out. You know, it made a good living taking the trash out the Halifax Street.
It always works. It pays the bills.
So, all right, let me ask you this. What's a book you've read that really kind of changed you?
Oh man, so it's funny. I read it back in college. It's How to Win Friends and Influence People.
That's like a very
the Dale Carnegie book. Yep. I mean, it's so simple, and it's an easy read, man.
Yeah.
It's just, and it's so funny. Even now, I will go back and look at like parts of it because it's all just, it's so true. And I think he wrote that thing like what, 80 years ago,
or
60 years
still ago. Applicable,
and it's still applicable. Yeah. So I think that's probably the best one.
Yeah, that seems to be a very recurring one we hear on this. So, well, okay, what's something unique about you that most people might not know that's totally different, or something you've done, or what?
Have you had Ward Richmond on here?
Yeah.
Okay.
But he didn't have, I think I know what you're going to say, and I think you should say it.
What, the Ironman?
Yeah.
I would say probably doing an Ironman.
That's pretty intense.
Ward's done like 5 or 6 of them.
Yeah.
So that's why I was asking what he said.
Yeah.
But I would say that was probably the one thing, just because, and I don't even know why the fuck I did it at the end of the day. I think it's
probably, you got to work out like 4 hours a day.
Yeah. And it was, so I'd done a half Ironman, and the first, when I got done doing it, I remember my dad asked me, he's like, are you just going to do a half? And I was like, oh, okay, well, no, I'm going to do a full.
You're not going to get a 13.1 sticker. You're going to get the 26.2 sticker.
So I did a full one. And so I did it actually in Arizona, and, it was in November, and I was thinking, okay, this is perfect. Arizona, it'll be mild, relatively flat. And it was in Phoenix, so I was like, good place to go. And I get there, and I do the swim, and it's like in a concrete lake in Phoenix. And then I get on the bike, and we ride out the desert, which was awesome. But about 50 miles into this bike ride, it just starts fucking pouring. in the desert. And I remember like riding my bike in the rain thinking, son of a bitch, like I picked this place just because I wanted to go someplace dry and it's raining its ass off. But it was great. It was a like one time experience. I did like that, knocked out a marathon same time. So one and done.
How long did you train for that?
Fuck, probably about 18 months. And it was like, it was funny. My wife, well, she was my fiance then, but it was funny. She was like, how many of these are you going to do? And I'm like, just one.
Yeah.
She's like, okay, good. But it was just like a lot of 4-hour rides and a lot of just stuff by yourself.
Yeah.
Which is kind of lonely and boring.
Yeah.
But it was fun. I can say I did it. I mean, I didn't get like the tattoo or the sticker or any of that bullshit.
Yeah.
I was just like, okay, one and done.
Yeah.
So that's it.
That's pretty, I mean, that takes a lot of commitment and just a lot of loneliness. Like
for someone that doesn't mind talking and likes talking, it was was the hardest part. And I remember someone asked me, they're like, did you like piss yourself on the bike? And I'm like, fuck no, I'm not out there trying to break a world record. I stopped at a fucking porta potty.
To
go. But it was fun. And I'd say that's probably the one thing, unique thing.
That's pretty cool. So I want to tell you this. I did a sprint, I guess, and it was like an 800 meter swim and a 25 mile bike and a 5K or whatever. I was drunk one night with a friend, and she was like, I'm going to do this. I was like, I'll do it with you. And so I started training for it, and I didn't call anybody on what to do or anything. So I just went to like a pool and swam in a pool. So we start in the lake and do the swim.
Did you freak out?
Dude.
It's dark and you put your head underwater and you don't see shit.
And you're just getting punched and kicked and it's run just over. Like, I was like, I think I might drown.
Yeah.
Like, and literally I was the last one to get out of the fucking lake. I got to the boat ramp and I was like taking a step at a time, just cramping. I was like, I got to go bike and run now. I was like,
I mean, you're like lightheaded, you're nauseous, you're everything all at once. And you're like, son of a bitch, that was only 10 minutes.
Yeah. This,
like hour and a half long thing.
I was not prepared for that.
No.
That was.
If it makes you feel better, I was like that, like the first time I did a sprint.
Yeah.
And mine was like, I think I was really hungover too, because I'd been out the night before. And I remember throwing up during the run, but it was the same deal. I remember like getting run over and I'm like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Why do I even want to do this?
Yeah. I was like, oh man, I got out. I was literally the last one out of the lake. I was just like, shit. So, but I got the bike done, got the run done. It was on a Sunday. The Cowboys were playing the Patriots. I went to Wingstop. I got 20 wings and a 12 pack of Coors Light and fucking hammered it. Watch the Cowboy game. Well, awesome, man. This has been great, dude.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Incredible story.
Fun.
We'll do it again. This is, we always got stuff going on. We just got a deal done. We got two deals working right now. So, yeah, you're keeping my brokerage career alive right now, Matt. Thank you. I appreciate it.
That's my goal. I just want to keep you around. I don't want you to go into retirement.
Yeah. Just keep me a little relevant. So, well, anyways, Matt Elliott, everybody. Thank you.
Thanks.